But I always tell people, you know, people going to rent or buy or live under the bridge. So if they're not buying, they're going to rent. So if you got to, you know, they got to live somewhere. I mean, during the recession, people still had to have a place to live.
Welcome to the House Hacking Success Podcast, where you'll learn the path to free rent and financial freedom through real estate. Featuring your hosts, Brad LaBrie and Drew Klingler.
What's up, everybody? It's Brad from House Hacking Success, and today I want to talk to you about my absolute favorite real estate app, which is Landlordy. If you're anything like me, you're an action taker and a doer, which means that administrative work gets in the way of our progress. I am horrible at keeping track of receipts, keeping track of the safety checks I need to do and routine checkups on my properties, and keeping tabs on my tenants and the lease renewals and keeping tabs where my leases are. And Landlordy is an absolute lifesaver for me. With Landlordy, you can manage information about your properties, your tenants, keep contact information and documents easily accessible at your fingertips no matter where you are in the world. If you're a traveler like I am, you can find this information on the beach and get the information to the people that need it. You can track your expenses in seconds, keep them organized. Use device camera to add expense receipts in seconds, which is absolutely amazing. Landlordy will remind you on your landlord duties like late rent payments, upcoming lease renewals, or appliance safety checks. Manage your business on the road or from the beach. Keep your rental business and related documents a few touches away, day or night, with Landlordy. Start managing your rental business on your iPhone or iPad. Go to landlordy.com/househacking. For 30% off Landlordy Plus, which is absolutely amazing. I personally use it. Go there today for House Hacking Success listeners only.
Welcome to House Hacking Success. Today we have Rick Jarman on the show, who is my favorite Instagram follow. Rick, we appreciate you coming on today.
Guys, I'm glad to be here. I always say I'd rather be here than in the best jail in Tuscaloosa.
So we appreciate you coming on, and we know a lot about your story, but our listeners might not. If you would just kind of go back to your story back when you first got started, you did some live-in flips, which is a form of house hacking in itself. Talk a little bit about that experience as a youngster and kind of why you started doing that, and then the outcome of that and how it's turned into who you are today.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go all the way back. My dad was a World War II era man. You know, he had a complete mental breakdown when I was 3 years old. And I didn't find this out till about 4 years ago, but I have a brother 6 years older than I am. And when Dad got sick, you know, things were different back then. And they had, I don't know if they lost their house and car, sold it or what, but we were actually homeless for about 9 months. And my mother and I lived with one of her sisters and my brother with another. So I was raised, my dad was in the VA till I was about 15, and I got married at 18. He was in the VA hospital. So he was more like a big brother. So anytime anybody would be doing anything in my neighborhood, I'd be latching on, trying to learn things, you know, because I didn't have that man in my household, you know. But I knew my mother worked hard to keep a roof over her head. Now I know why, you know. But she instilled us in, you know, really strong work ethics. And we had to work young. In fact, if you go look on my Instagram page, there's a black and white picture. It's in 1969. I just turned 11 years old. So it'd been, 1964, maybe that's what it was. And my brother and I had a lawn service. I mean, you know, we don't mean like a lawnmower to cut yards. I mean, we had a trailer, three mowers. We cut yards 6 days a week during the summer. So we worked hard, and it's all I knew. So as he got older, I moved into a different kind of work. My first job I had where they actually cut your taxes was in 1969 when I was 14, was on a garbage truck with the city of Northport that summer, you know. So things couldn't do nothing but look up for me, because that was back in them days was some pretty hard work, you know, and kind of, you know, you going around to your friends' houses getting the garbage on the garbage truck. So it kind of put the want to him, if you know what I mean. So I worked all my life, did construction work the summer between my 11th and 12th grade year of high school. And that's when I found the love of what I wanted to do. And it's build houses and remodel houses, you know. And so when my wife was in college, we was putting her through college. I kept up rental property for other people. And that kind of wet my whistle as far as owning rental property. But our first house we bought when I was 21, fixed it up, moved in it. And we repeated that for about 2 years for three houses. So we were in it knee deep pretty early.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So talk about, I mean, we know who you are today. Tell listeners kind of like where you are now and what those experiences as a youngster doing those live-in flips kind of, you know, how much confidence that maybe boosted you as a young kid.
Okay. Well, you know, for me, it was the whole construction thing and flipping houses. It was, you know, back then, I mean, when I got married at 18, I was making minimum wage, you know, so that's $1.60 an hour. So by the time I'm 21, you know, I'm making a little better money, but you know, there's no extra money around. So back then you could assume an FHA loan if you had the equity. So the first house I bought, I assumed an FHA loan. I borrowed the second mortgage, you know, from an individual at a high rate of interest and basically got in the house for nothing other than closing costs. But we had to remodel it out of pocket. And that's how we got started. And we realized this house was about 40 years old. It was, you know, built after World War II. We sold it, moved in another one, you know, assumed another FHA loan. Little nicer house. By the third house, we'd moved up to a practically brand new three-bedroom, two-bath brick house on an acre of land, you know, and I'm like, you know, 23 years old, and each one of them would assume two FHA loans and one VA. And back then, you could assume a loan. It was two qualifications. You'd pay a $45 transfer fee, and if they held a mirror under your nose and you were breathing, you qualified. Fully assumable, you know, that's how it was back then.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. So now, you know, fast forward a little bit, you have, to my knowledge, about 100 or over 100 rental properties.
Close
you flip house. Huh? Yeah, 125 rental properties, which is, you know, out awesome. And you flip properties, you're active property flipper. Talk to the people out there who, you know, who haven't gone through maybe cycle in real estate, right? The last 10 years, especially for us younger individuals, the last 10 years have been, you know, boom. It's been nothing but up. It doesn't take a whole lot to, you know, even C-level, you know, players can do well in this kind of economy. Talk to the younger listeners like myself who haven't went through a cycle about okay. What 2008 was like and sustaining that and coming out on the other side and keeping the 125 and being active as a flipper.
Okay. Well, my story, I learned a lot of lessons in the late 90s. I basically had to start over. You find people have been in this business, in the construction and all long enough, and you go through that sometimes. About the same time, Donald Trump started over and all these people, we were all hit. And I learned a lot of things to do and not to do. So when 2008 hit, I was in a position, I had my rentals. You know, we were building houses, but we were able to pull back. You know, during that time, I wouldn't say we were making money. It was all about damage control. But here where I live, probably most of the builders, all but about four or five went out of business, you know. But I was able to come through it pretty, I don't want to say, unhurt, but we were okay. You know, we just wasn't making money, but we were surviving. But it's, you know, I like to tell everybody, go back. I used 1973 when I come out of high school. When I come out of high school, we had a gas embargo and we had a recession. I mean, you'd have to go to the gas pumps and hope you could get gas. It'd be lines. So I look at how many we've had since then. You know, it's been several. I think it's about five. And, of course, 2008 was the worst, you know. That's what, they call it the Great Recession. They'd have called it the Great Depression if it hadn't already been one. I mean, if you were in the real estate, construction, auto industry, whatever, it was tough.
Yeah.
And I tell people to not get overextended, be diversified. You know, what can happen? You can go to bed tonight and tomorrow. It's like the water was cut off. It changes. It's just that. And, you know, even if you've got property that was paid for, the banks wouldn't refinance it. I mean, they were in damage control. And you know, they wasn't even going after people wasn't paying. They're going after people paid the bills. I mean, they wanted, They're trying to renegotiate because values were dropping. Like right before 2008, I'd bought $1.4 million worth of lots, you know, in a subdivision, me and another guy. And all of a sudden, lots went down from being worth 40-something thousand to about 20-something. The bank's coming in wanting you to give them $200,000, you know, readjust your notes, because see what happens. As you know, when you loan out money, the banks loan out money. If they loan out a dollar, they got to keep so many dollars in reserve. Mm-hmm. And if they loan it out on property that's worth $500,000, all of a sudden it's worth $300,000, they've had to have more in reserve. So the feds were breathing down the bank's neck, you know, and it was, I tell folks, it was like the Wild West at that time. It was something.
And it's almost, you know, from my understanding, and I love talking to, you know, experienced people like yourself who've been through it, and they're talking from experience rather than out of some book they read or whatever. But, you know, basically, it, you know, the well dried up, right? I mean, the spouts turned off. You could, like you said, you couldn't even refinance cash paid properties. And for people, right. And, you know, leveraging is great way. Obviously, you leverage some of your properties, right? And it's a great way to grow. But at the same time, if you don't have the discipline to keep reserves for yourself and keep, you know, liquid assets, I mean, in tough times like that, you're not going to get it from a bank, from my understanding.
Yeah, they're not going. And, you know, it's, they just quit loaning. And, you know, you ever seen the movie The Big Short? I'm sure you have. See, at that time, I can't talk about it much because I'm under a gag order, but I had a bond issue and I had did a swap, and that's what that was about, you know. And all of a sudden the bank's telling you, hey, you don't have, a bond issue works. You would pay interest quarterly and principal once a year. And the swap, you come in and pay money to get a fixed rate. So I had like a fixed rate for 5 years. Well, they come in all of a sudden and say, well, your rate's not fixed. Well, that's what was sold to me for, you know. So, because the banks had never had it to come up. They never, you know, it was like they were selling a product and all of a sudden it changed and they didn't know how to deal with things. I mean, it was, there's never been a time where banking was so, I mean, it just, it was, I was president of our Home Builders Association in 2009, you know, which, man, that's a rough time to be president right in the middle of it. And I was telling them at our awards banquet, I said, look around. How many bankers you see? We had one banker there. Usually the bankers are there, you know, patting you on the back and wanting to loan you money, you know. But they were all running and hiding because they were putting people out of business. The builders were, there was a lot of, you know, anger and hostility, you know. And of course, they're trying to survive and keep their jobs, you know. So it was... wasn't nothing fun about it, I can tell you that. But, you know, it was a tough time. And, you know, we, like I said, we were fortunate enough to be able to pull back because of our rentals. And we actually, during that time, my son, you know, I could live off my rentals, but we're talking 11 years ago, so I wasn't at a position that I am now with my rentals. So I had a daughter-in-law that had just finished University of Alabama in interior design, couldn't find a job. My son, he was running the new construction, so we wasn't building. So we opened up an interior and antique shop, and we were buying furniture and flipping furniture. Did that for 4 years, and I really enjoyed it. Wasn't making any money because, excuse me, I didn't take any of the money out. I let them, you know, take it, but it kept them something to do. But it's just like flipping houses. I mean, you find a piece of furniture, you buy it right, you know, mid-century, you paint it up, you sell it. And you know, it was good little business. We ended up doing about $140,000 a year. You know, time we shut it down because it was over with. I had my son's first child was going to be born. They had to decide if they were going to put her in daycare, or, you know, or keep the store going. Because my son, he didn't care anything about it, but he knew it was just a living. Yeah. And you know what you got to do. I mean, you know, me, I had my rentals.
So, you know, it's possible that a recession is coming up pretty soon. People are anticipating it. Obviously, we can't predict when it's going to come, if it's going to be next year or 10 years. But there's probably people out there that are overextended right now. What kind of advice would you give to people that are really trying to grow, that are overextended? How could they prepare for an oncoming recession?
In rental property, I don't worry about it as bad. If you've got the right kind of rentals, you will be okay, you know, pretty much. If you have your loan set up But, you know, if you're in high dollar rentals, it could change on you fast. You know, the good working class people, upper, lower, you know, they're going to rent. They're going to do whatever it takes. I wasn't hurt by that on any of it. In fact, I had a private money lender that I worked with, and I was fortunate to buy stuff that I knew I wouldn't keep that didn't fit my criteria, but stuff that I was able to pick up on deals that, to sell when the recession turned. And heck, I added almost $2 million to my net worth, you know, right after the recession, you know, some stuff I'd bought. And so
that's awesome. Now, you know, being younger individual, right? Like I've been buying and selling houses for 6 years now, and at every turn, there's somebody that's predicting a market crash. When, you know, what advice would you give to the noise out there versus the reality? And how should, you know, because early in life, there is a time for maybe taking risks, but there's also a time to mitigate that risk and be, you know, just speaking to your younger self in this climate where the world is so, everything's so much faster and information is readily available from all corners. What advice would you give somebody to cut through that noise?
Well, you know, you say you watch my videos. You know, the other day I did one when I had a modular home center while I was building houses, and I'd gotten hooked up with a company in Birmingham that built modular homes. And I made a statement in there that I really hadn't thought about. Y'all, excuse me, I've been having some allergy problems.
No problem.
But when you're young, you're fearless. I mean, if you're an entrepreneur and you've got that mindset, you know, you think you got the golden touch. I mean, I had it. I thought I had it. Found out in 19, late 90s, it wasn't as golden as I thought it was. But when everything you've always done worked, and all of a sudden, no matter what you do, it doesn't work, that's how it is when a recession hits.
Yeah.
So no matter how good a house you build or how good a house you fix up to flip. But I always tell people, you know, people going to rent or buy or live under the bridge. So if they're not buying, they're going to rent. So if you got to, you know, they got to live somewhere. I mean, during the recession, people still had to have a place to live. So if you're smart and get the right kind of rental property, you'll make it. But now if you're flipping houses or you're overextended on a bunch of apartments and you're counting on appreciation, and not when you buy a piece of property, that's when you make your money. And you needs to be a deal, and don't overpay. Don't buy something and count on appreciation or tax advantages. That's all icing on the cake. You need to buy right when you buy. That's the big secret.
So is there a specific class of rental properties that you focus on, like A, B, C?
Yeah, I like C or, you know, upper Ds. I deal a lot of Section 8. My checks came in regardless, you know. But, you know, a lot of this terminology I've had to learn since I've been on here, all the, you know, the abbreviate house hacking. I didn't know what house hacking was. We call it working class, lower work, you know. But if you stay with, I mean, people that got, you know, that have regular jobs, they didn't lose their jobs, most of them, during the recession. You know, things may change them, but those people kept working. Maybe their kid lost a job and has to move back home, but they got to live somewhere. That's why rental is so good, the right kind of rentals. But now say you got a bunch of high-end apartments and people, maybe these people, professional people, they go to losing their jobs. They got to go home, find something cheaper, do something different. That's what happens during the recession.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if you've got the kind of property that people are going to keep on working or the government's helping pay the rent, hey, you know, a Section 8's underrated. People think, slum, stuff like that. That's not so. I mean, I got houses worth $150,000 Section 8 people in them. That's what they're worth now, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I deal with two cities, Tuscaloosa and Northport, Alabama, Section 8. Tuscaloosa direct deposits my check every month by the 10th. Every month by the 10th, Northport mails me a check. Some tenants, they pay all the rent, some of it part. Some of it, the tenant has to pay part of it. But, hey, you can count on it. Even when the government shut down that time for a little while, it didn't affect my checks. They kept coming.
Yeah. So in my limited, you know, experience compared to someone like you, the thing that I've learned most is that, you know, real estate isn't really that challenging or difficult, right? If you spend some time with it and learn it, it's not all that difficult. But I think the thing that differentiates people from like long sustainability versus just kind of short term and they get out or whatever is the mindset, right? And I know enough about your generation versus my generation of what on the grind means, or, you know, especially what's portrayed on Instagram of being a grinder. And, you know, a lot of times they're, you know, they woke up at 10:30 eating a bowl of cereal and posting on Instagram about being on the grind, right? And what do you think, what does it take to sustain that kind of mindset as a young entrepreneur growing up in such a highlight reel society?
Well, I think anybody that's going to be an entrepreneur, you got to have that hunger. You know, you want things. I came up poor. That was a motivator for me. Then you start having children. That's a motivator. When you, I don't know if either one, I assume y'all are married and have kids.
When you married, but no kids.
No kids. But when your world will change when you have children. You got not only then, if you got a wife counting on you, but kids, you know, that's a motivator right there. You know, I hear people talking about all the motivation, you know, that's, you know, the money's always motivated me. And I hear people saying, oh, I don't really like real estate. Real estate's just the means to the end. No, not me. I love the industry and I love making the money.
Yeah.
I've got a friend of mine that's about 83 now. And I guess when I turned 60 is when it was, that's almost 5 years ago. And I knew the answer, but I asked him, I said, Lee, man's name Lee Paik. I said, why do you keep doing this? Cause he's hustling every day. Still, he's, you know, got runs about as many houses as I do and been at it forever. Well, he says, one, he said, it helps keep me young. Two, I enjoy it. And he said, three, I like the money. I mean, people don't understand your mind thinking, like, how old are you guys, if you don't mind me asking?
Mid-20s. We're 26, 27.
Yep. I used to tell my kids, make them mad. I said, I got boots older than y'all. But the thing is, your mind doesn't change as your body ages, you know, when you get older. If that's in you to hustle, you're still going to hustle. I had to pull back every day because I was 60 before I realized I could stay home all day on a Saturday, not go work a little while, check jobs, and go to the office to about one. I mean, unless I was doing family stuff, you know. But my hobby is my business because I love it. You know, I used to play music, but if I wasn't doing those things, I'd work. I mean, you know, I get as excited when I buy a deal today as I did the first one. And just because you get age on you, it doesn't change. If that's in you, you know. Mm-hmm. I hear some people are just, I think they're lying to themselves when they say, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm going to quit. Let me tell you, when you get 45 or 50 or 60 and you built your life, building your business, and you're successful at, you're not going to just walk away.
And that might be maybe even another sort of misnomer or even sometimes lie that is sort of penetrated out there, which is passive income. I mean, there are forms of passive income, but the majority of things that, in my opinion, and I think you might agree, if you're going to build something sustainable like you have, it's going to be anything but passive for the first, you know, X amount of years. Would you agree with that? And it's out there. Everyone thinks, you know, I'm going to get into this. Like, I'm going to get into, you know, for instance, like network marketing because it's passive income, or I'm going to get into, you know, rental property because it's passive income. And it takes a lot of active, you know, work to create that sustainable, you know, something that's become recession proof and things of that nature.
Well, you know, when people talk about passive income and somewhat it can be if somebody else is managing it, whatever, but you still got to make that payment every month.
Yeah.
You got to write the check. They got drafted out of your account, whatever. You still got to see it. You got insurance. You still got to get your property taxes paid. If that people manage your property call and tell you, hey, you just had a $6,000 heating and cooling system go out, you know, we need to get this fixed. And, you know, what do we do? Well, then you got to give them the money to do it. I mean, it's never really passive. I mean,
right.
It has phases of passiveness, you know, if that's a word, but, I will say this, cause we're talking about the younger people. I think y'all get a bad rap. You know, you hear all this stuff. Let me tell you, I'm a baby boomer. They was lazy baby boomers, you know. Not everybody was entrepreneurs. Not everybody, you know. Some of the work ethics may have been a little different, but, you know, each generation wants more than their parents have, and they want it now. You know, my generation was the same way, you know. So, like I said, I think it's just more visibility with social media and stuff, you know. I tell my son, like I said, he just caught the tail end of, you know, he's 38. I tell him, just keep doing the things you do, because there are a lot of lazy people out there and that are not going to hustle. They want it, but they don't want to do what it takes. Same way it was in my generation. I mean, I see people now that I went to school with retiring. Maybe they got a little old check coming in, or they're waiting on they're getting a Social Security check, retired at 62. You know, people don't realize that when you retire at 62, you can only draw about $17,000 something, you know, for, you know, that's all you're going to draw.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they allow you to make. In other words, you got your retirement stuff. I mean, I think I'm making that plain, you know, but like my wife, she's a retired school teacher. She draws, she taught for 25 years, master degree, double certified. You know, she pays our insurance, but her check from the retirement from the government's only about $1,500 a month. How are you going to live on that?
Right.
And then she's got her teacher's retirement by the time they take out the insurance. I remember she asked me when I turned 62, was I going to retire? Because a lot of people do, you know, because you take less money. I said, you can't live like you live me retired at 62, you know. I have no desire. I have no desire to ever quit, you know. I want to keep doing it. But, you know, people that I see my age that are retiring, they can say, well, we're going to travel. They don't have any money. You know, they draw a little bit, you know, they all either got to go back to work or so, you know, building.
And that's maybe another characteristic of people that build like sustainability is you said, you know, I don't really ever want to quit. And, you know, that's a thing, you know, like no matter what it is, you find something you love within the real estate industry. At least I have found this. And it just, you know, the term retirement just doesn't even suit what I, you know, what my life's like, what I want my lifestyle to be. I mean, you know, sitting on a beach and you know, sipping, you know, margarita is fine for a time, but there, you know, I would get restless after, you know, more than, you know, 2-3 weeks.
I mean, I give you a good example. Me and two of my buddies, we owned a condo, but it was 4 months old when we bought it. This is for the recession. We owned it for 13 years in Gulf Shores, Alabama, right on the beach. And we didn't rent it. We were all self-employed, so every third week was your week. For almost 13 years, I never spent a full 7 days down there. I mean, I'd get antsy. I'd ready to get back, you know. I'd go, you know. And it's nothing about being a workaholic or loving money. It's just, if you're that way, you're that way. It's like a curse. I mean, you just got to embrace it and move on. Because, and everybody's not like that, but everybody can't do this business either. Everybody can't take the hard times, the good times. And, you know, it's easy to, you know, like right now, it's great. Everybody's happy. Everything's great and wonderful. You got all this appreciation. You know, you get a house finished. If you flip in time, you get it finished. If it's priced right, it's sold. That's not the real world. That's not the norm. Now, it's been the norm for a while, but it will change. Mm-hmm. And if you're prepared and you're willing to, the folks that are workers and really want it will still do all right, even due to recessions and everything, and they don't last forever. I mean, the recession 2008 literally lasted about a year and a half. The effects were felt a lot longer, but you had a lot of people that were taken out of the game, and then you had a lot of young people just getting in the game, and because they can borrow money, because the banks have still got a loan. When the banks get to where they can loan money again, they're going to loan it. And so these guys that got messed up and couldn't do business because they got, you know, the credit screwed, whatever, lost stuff. With a young bunch coming in, is reaping the rewards. They're buying these houses unfinished. They're buying these properties these people lost. Well, you know, the banks got to loan money. When they start back loaning, they go loan. I mean, like I said, my son, he's been working with me for 20 years now. It'll be 20 in May. I told him, I said, son, it ain't always like this. These bankers go come around, pat you on the back, and, you know, they're your best buddy, but you let it get bad, they'll cut you and run. And he saw that in 2008. But it's nothing against bankers. It's just the nature of the beast. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I don't want, I know this is a family like show and I don't want to tell it wrong, but I used to say builders and investors, we got, you know, we just, you know, the banks, they quit loaning. We talk to them, they start loaning, we line up to borrow again. That's just how it is. I mean, I started to say, we're like, oh, we're going to take it and go with it. You know, you're going to do it. I mean, you know, you've got to leverage if you do this business to grow. I mean, but I hear people say, well, I'm going to buy one house, pay for it, and get it. You take forever to get anywhere. You got to leverage. You've got to be willing to, you know, put your neck on the line a little. That's why you won't do it when you're young. And that's the problem for me, is to pull back, because I still want to do things. But I'm at a point now, like, well, do I want to buy more houses? One week I say I do, one week I say I don't, you know, but I still want to flip, because I'm like this. I got a 4 grandkids. They're all approximately 5 years apart. The oldest one's going to be getting a car this summer. Well, I plan to buy her a car. Well, I plan to put her through college. I got 3 more. I plan to do the same thing. I had one of my mentors when I was starting out, was my attorney also. He did all his grandkids that way, and that's the way I want to do. So I'm doing now for the future generations. Yeah. I've had people ask me my exit plan. I don't plan to exit. I'm not selling. You know, I've enjoyed putting it together, living it and doing it, and have lived good, you know. But I've also created something for my kids and my grandkids. Yeah. You know, we're like, I did a video this week. My son and I renewed a couple of notes, and like, we got 5 years left on, he and I own 26 houses together. Well, those, we got several of them like that down in the teens. Well, 5 years, them two will be paid for. That's paid for now unless you refinance them. Well, I was telling my wife the other day, I've got 46 houses on one note that I owe less than $800,000 on. Well, some of these houses are worth $100,000. So you can imagine the equity I have, with the payments approximately $12,000 a month. But to generate the rent, it throws off, is unreal. But I was telling my wife, I was thinking, you know, I said, you realize in about 5 more years, we're going to get a $12,000 a month raise. And she didn't, she can't comprehend. But then the other day I got thinking, I could go and refinance maybe 10 of them, set it up 15 years again, I'd leave 36 cash, you know, free and clear. And I'd go from a payment of $12,000 a month to about $3,000 something a month. So I'd get like a $7,000 a month raise. There's just so many things you could do with this business.
So let's get into the X's and O's a little bit. First, let's talk about Utah. You've had a couple videos about like banks, you know, doing rehab loans, right? You talk about the 80-80. They'll loan 80% of the loan. They'll loan 80% of the rehab, right? Let's talk a little about that. But then also after that, maybe you can touch a little bit upon, I'm sure everyone's unfamiliar with what you're talking about, one note, 46 houses. You can talk a little bit about how you've structured and built your 125 portfolio, but talk a little bit about like financing side. A lot of people are really intrigued, especially young people that don't really understand the financing world.
Well, you know, I hear so many people on Instagram, and you'll never hear me get on here and contradict people, because that's not what I'm about. I'm just trying to help folks and share. But I hear somebody say, well, you can only have 5 loans at a bank, or you can only have 4. You know, commercial loan banks, I'm running wide open this morning for some reason, but I'm sorry, guys. I hope I'm doing you a good job. Banks, when you go to a bank sometimes to borrow money, like we're talking about commercial lending, if they turn you down, it doesn't necessarily mean you had a bad deal or the deal wasn't good or they don't like you. Banks can get overextended in certain type of loans. And that doesn't mean it's another bank's that way. So if you get turned down, because if they turn you down and say, well, why? Don't be afraid to ask them. And then the bank says, well, we have too much in single family right now, lend it, or we have too much in multifamily. Well, it's nothing to do with your deal. It's the bank. So you go to another bank. But that being said, I hear people, you know, saying how much the bank will loan as much as you qualify for and the property you're buying. It's based more on the property on the commercial end. But yeah, like I said, that this particular loan, when I originally took it out, it had 50 something houses in it. And I was complaining about some flood insurance. And they released five of them because I was going to move the loan. Well, they didn't want them to move that, lose that loan at the time. It was about $900,000 on 50-something houses. Heck no. Because they, you know, they're sitting so pretty. Mm-hmm. But you got to, if you want to grow, you got to deal with the banks. I mean, you know, you just, that's a, it's a fact. But the banks, during the whole time during the recession, they never come and say, hey, we want you to turn your keys in on your rental property. If you're paying, that's, they got to have it. I mean, yeah, they're selling money. Yeah. Banks selling money.
So, so for the people unfamiliar, which I am, but talking to, you know, some of the newer folks that listen to our show, the difference between commercial and residential, what you're talking about is some people talk about the fact that you can't have more than four or five residential loans. But what you've done, which is what most seasoned investors do, is they take the, you know, the residential properties you own and you get one commercial loan for those properties. What you were talking about, having the 46 on one note. Talk about the difference between a commercial and more of a, you know, residential loan.
Well, you know, when you're doing a rental house, it becomes commercial, even though it's not. We think of commercial as multifamily or commercial buildings. But if you're doing a rental house, that's a commercial. You know, you don't qualify for all the things that you would be doing if you're buying your own individual home. Mm-hmm. But they still will loan 4, 5, 1, 6, 10, whatever. But, you know, a lot of people think they reach a certain level and that's all they loan. They'll loan, you know, like I said, if the loans are good, it's nothing special. It's the same loan for, you know, like, oh, I heard somebody say, well, what they're doing, then they just tied it against your equity. No, if they loan me a loan for 50 houses, it's the same loan as they loan me for one in the commercial. Mm-hmm. It's just a bigger package, you know. But I had bought my houses, and the reason I had a partner at one time on about 50 of my houses, and I bought him out. He got caught up in the recession. He was an electrical contractor. All of his builders went out of business, you know, and I was fortunate enough that I was sitting pretty good, so I was able to buy him out. Well, I had to take that loan and go to the bank, see, because I had to buy him out. So I paid, I got $1.5 million loan. I paid $500,000 down, financed $1.5 million. $1,550,000 is what it was actually. So that's what the loan started out at. I do 15-year loans. Everything I do, that's another thing. Everybody talks 30-year loan. They say, well, you get more cash flow. Well, yeah. But, you know, if you sit down and look at the difference in the money you're paying, maybe you're getting $100 more a month right now on a 30-year loan. If you're not living off of that money, get it paid down, reap the rewards. If you're 29 right now, and you do a 30-year loan, you're almost 60 before it's paid for. But mm-hmm. I'm going to call it, say you're 30, you do 15, you're 45. Look how many years you've got that full money coming in, plus you can grow with it. And, you know, you look at amortization schedule and look at the difference.
Yeah.
It's not that much. I mean, it's usually on a 15-year loan, you get a better rate than a 30. Plus, that's why I always push to get a good deal. When you get a good deal, that help offset that.
That's a great point. That's a great point. You know, and it comes back a little bit. I've seen a lot of people show, you know, I look at these as an agent, right? Amortization schedules all the time. And you know, there is a drastic difference. And like you said, you know, a lot of times we get caught up in not wanting to delay our own gratification, right? People want to live off, you know, money instantly. But somebody like you who is in it for something greater than just money. You know, you love real estate. You know, you've talked about it repeatedly. You don't want to retire, right? It's a lot easier. And I'm very similar. Like I'm constantly delaying gratification and pushing things back to just throw things, but, you know, throw double payments on a mortgage. You know, my wife and I do things like that. And it is, you know, a lot of people don't want to do that. They want to live off the money now. They want to, you know, buy the car and stuff. But that is a great point. You can save a lot of money on a 15-year mortgage, you know, long-term if you decide to go that route.
Yeah. And, you know, most commercial loans, they're going to look at it. Some of them now would do 7-year fix. Most of them, it's a 5-year fix, amortized over 15, 20. A lot of them won't do a 30-year am, you know, 20, 25, maybe the longest the banks would do a lot of times on commercial banks. Not saying all of them, I'm just talking about kind of a rule of thumb. You know, some of them would do different, like, you know, credit unions would do 5 loans and do different. Everybody's a little different, but you're just, running like kind of a standard thing, 15, 20, 25 years is what they look at. But it makes a big difference. Excuse me. Because if you have a job and this is not what you do full time, well, you can afford to let that thing pay down. I mean, you know, and I'm not a big one. I don't double up on payments. If I'm going to double up, I'm going to be paying it on something else. I won't. You know, I want more, you know, when I was building mine. And see, it's something else I hadn't even touched on in 2000. So we come out of the recession, you know, recession was 2008. When 2011, here where I live in Tuscaloosa, we had a major tornado that I lost total 26 rental houses and had damaged probably 70 other ones. And there were probably 7,000 something structures destroyed here in this town. So it took me a little while to, even though I had insurance, I had to deal with that for 3 years, you know, before I got to find all the money. So you lost houses, you lost income. So you're slowly building back. I didn't build them back. I went and bought more. A lot of people don't understand that you can do that with insurance. You know, they might try to make you think if you don't build it back, they hold what they call recoverable depreciation. So like if you got a rental house and it burns and your company says, okay, well, if you don't build it back, we're only going, like I'll give you a good example. I had one that burned a while back with $64,000 worth of coverage. They held $24,000 for recoverable depreciation, but I wasn't going to build it back. But I done learned enough through the tornado deal. I said, well, that's, you know, I'll just go buy another house. So how long do I have? They said, well, in a reasonable amount of time. Well, what's a reasonable amount of time? I mean, they're not used to getting that kind of, they don't want you to know these things, see. So I went and bought another house. The house I bought, it had to be worth the $64,000 minus the land of the one I bought because I still had the land on when I had the fire. I get the rest of my money then, so I get my $24,000. Wait about 6-7 months, now I'm building the house back. I'm remodeling it back. You know, it wasn't, they totaled it, but hey, it wasn't that bad as a kitchen fire. But, you know, I'm in the construction business. So when I get through with it, I'll have about $30,000 a house free and cleared at a rent for $675. You know, it's just, but they try to make, you know, you just don't take everything just because they tell you.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt about it.
People are bad about that, you know. I mean, I don't know. I may be a little off track, but that's.
Now speak to the 80-80 loan that you use a lot.
Okay. Yeah, I'm big on that. And actually, I have some banks, and it's because I've been at it so long, I guess they'll loan up to 85%. But what I do is I find a piece of property. Don't go to the bank with a piece of property till you have your numbers of what it's going to cost to remodel it, whether it's a rental, flip, or whatever. Have your hard numbers worked up. Then go to the bank. The bank will appraise that piece of property after the repair, you know, they are after the repaired value, they'll loan you 80% of that amount, you know, just 80%. Because if you go and just get 80% of the house, you're leaving money on the table. Now, they're not going to give you all that money right then. They're going to make you make draws as the repairs are completed, you know. They'll come out and inspect it. Now, me, I've been dealing with some of them so long, like I bought a house, in fact, one I replaced that firehouse with. It was on the market for 117 and marked it down to 98. I went and told the people how much it was going to cost to fix it. I got it for 78. It was a deal that the courts were handling it because this person had been moved into like a nursing home and the government was involved in it. But I got it for 78,000. I showed them how much I was going to put in it. They loaned me the money. I walked out of that closing with a check for $14,000. So don't tell me you can't buy 100% sometime.
Right.
But that's another whole thing. I mean, I was raised during the time 100% financing. I don't talk about it much because I don't want to get in arguments with people, but don't tell me what I can't do when I did it and still right. do it, you know?
Right. Right. No, absolutely. And the way that we, you know, the reason why house hacking for us is so powerful is the fact that, you know, I've done rehab loans where I literally came out of pocket 3%, right? Because it was my primary resident, it was a 4-unit. And so, you know, there are a lot of things. You talk about the 80-80, that's for non, you know, it's not your primary residence. Right. But as house hackers, especially young kids in their 20s, which is primarily our audience, you know, doing rehab loans and being able to do like 97% financing on the entire thing, right? I mean, I did a 203K loan where I literally appreciated the property by $130,000, and I came out of pocket 3%, right? Yeah. And so, and like there, you know, but in, and you live for free, you know, and that's why it's so powerful. And there are loans like this, 80-80, which I work with investors as an agent, you know, doing things like this often, which can, you know, really be beneficial for investors trying to do, whether you're flipping or just doing more of like the burst strategy where you're remodeling houses and then renting them, you know, it's doable.
Oh yeah. Well, and I'm glad, you know, the Burr method, you know, I kind of made fun of, but not made fun of, but I talked about the Burr method and overdrive the other day. You know, I had two duplexes and two houses that were cash flowing $6,000 a month, but I had them paid down on the old $91,000 on all four pieces of property. Well, I refinanced them, kept them cash flowing. They're still generating positive cash flow of $4,000 a month, and I cashed out $168,000. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, where else? I mean, it's like saving plans. That's money. When you borrow money like that, you don't pay taxes on it.
Yeah, exactly.
But getting back to the you know, remodeling money to buy it when you're fixing up. Here's the other thing. Okay, you got real hard numbers and you go to the bank. The bank wants to see numbers that are actual costs. I mean, if ceramic tile is going $550 a foot, square foot installed, that's what you need to show. Maybe painting, you know, labor, material labor is running $4 a square foot. But say you got a cousin that can paint for you, that paint for you $10 an hour in a case of beer or something, you know. You save money like that money I had. You're not doing anything wrong. The bank wants to see the true numbers. Me being a contractor, I show them the true numbers, but I'm able to do it for less. Mm-hmm. So this particular house, I showed them $30,000 worth of real repair costs. But in reality, I'm able to do it for about $22,000. So they loaned me $16,000 for repair money. So I got everything I needed, except for the difference between 16 and 22. I bought the house, repair money. I had to come out of pocket $4,000. And then I sold the house for $159,000. Mm-hmm. So it's just so many ways to make money in this business.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And I know I may be getting too in-depth all over the place. I mean, I can go as deep with it as you want to go, but we don't want to, you know, I don't want to sound like a toot my horn or no to, I just have experienced a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are the lessons you've learned from being in real estate? Because I mean, you know, we've talked a little about cycles and things like that, but what have you actually learned from maybe the game of real estate that you would like to pass on to someone at 20 years old or in their 20s?
When you buy it, the price you pay when you buy it, that's where your money's made, and everything else is gravy.
Yeah.
When you buy something and you buy it right, you've made your money, and then the money that you do with it on the backside is just gravy. It's got to be a deal. Always be a deal. Don't think you got to buy something. If it's not a deal, wait.
And how do you, you know, because being in real estate, like you have been so long, and you know, I spend almost every day in real estate, you know, we kind of, you know, you start to get a feel for it. But for when somebody started out, like how do they start to get a feel for it when they're not an agent and they can't just go into any property? Like how do you start to get familiar with what is a deal and what isn't a deal?
Okay. I like to tell people, it's like when you start driving, when you get your permit, you can't just hit the road driving. You know, you got to learn how to drive. Then you get your license, you still check. You've got to study it. You got to learn your market. I always preach that, learn your market. People say, well, how do you learn your market? You go and see what you figure out what price range you're interested in, so, or what type you want to rent or whatever. So then you got to figure out, what are they selling for? I mean, there's no shortcut. It's work. You figure out what pieces of property they're selling for or what they're asking for, and then you try to find out what they sold for. And, you know, there's so many things. Like I just got on Zillow my first time the other day. I've never been, because I just deal right here in my town. I have my MLS. It was a world of things I saw on there, even though a lot of it may not be as accurate as, you know, people make fun of it, but it's still, it's a good start. You've got to learn your market, learn your market, learn your market. I mean, if you don't know what something costs, you don't know if you're getting a good deal or not. I don't care if you're buying a pair of tennis shoes or a pair of blue jeans. You got to know what it costs. So then you determine what's a good deal, not a deal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, you know, everybody wants somebody just to, I get all these DMs to say, well, how do you learn your market? They think I say, okay, we do this. That's it. You got to study it. You got to work it. There's nothing about this business that doesn't take work.
Yeah. And work is, you know, everyone craves that, you know, one click to the finish line type thing. And it really is just such a process. And it takes time and it takes making mistakes. And you know, one of the things that I try to relay and whether it's right or wrong is the fact that, you know, and Brandon Turner from Bigger Pockets talks about this all the time. The fact that, like, you know, your first deal, everyone wants a grand, you know, home run deal on the first one. And that's fine. And if you can find it, great. But a lot of times, if you can just get, that's why I think house hacking is so powerful. If you can just get in and you can just do a break even, you know, it may not be a great, great deal, but it's certainly not a bad deal. And you get into the property and you learn on that first deal and you learn from your mistakes and you make some mistakes, right? I mean, I lost my first property. I lost every penny I put into it, right? The tenant got murdered. You know, people broke in, stole my copper wire. It was just a mess, right? I lost, you know, more than 10 grand. I was 20 years old when I bought it. But like that experience taught me way more than I could have ever done by paying 10 grand for a course or something. I feel it was experience. And I just relay to people, like, you know, getting in and getting started in real estate is so important. And, you know, just hitting a single is fine. You know, hit the home run later in your journey.
I have people, when I hear people, they say they've never lost money. They just hadn't did many deals.
Yeah.
You either can get overconfident, you get too busy. You know, even when I was building houses, you take, like we used for 14 years, we did a bunch of custom houses. You know, when you build one house, you price the next one on the one you just did. Then you get to the end, you realize you didn't make on the other one as much as you thought, but you'd priced it against it. And that same thing happens when you're flipping houses or whatever, you know. And you just, each piece of property has to stand on its own. Each piece of property, you know, don't count on appreciation. Don't count on your tax advantages. It needs to stand on its own. When you buy it, then you'll be okay.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. So what are your long-term goals in real estate?
Have you ever seen the movie, the Intern with Robert De Niro?
Yeah. Yeah, I have.
He'd be 2 years old and the guy asked him, said, where do you see yourself in 10 years? that's kind of like me. Hell, I just hope I'm clicking here in 10 years, you know. But no, my long-term goals is to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm going to keep buying property, not as aggressively as I have in the past. But I can't turn down a deal. Like I said, I've told my son, I don't know if we're going to buy anymore. You know, we got enough. I mean, but flipping is what I'm concentrating on really right now. Just other than, you know, I have a good cash flow. I'm sitting good there. Because I'm you know, like I said, I got to buy a car here in about less than a year from my granddaughter. And then she'll be starting college in a couple of years. So you flip a house, you make you 20,000, 30,000, 40,000. Or if you hit a good lick like I did the other day and make you about 74,000, hey, you ready to roll, you know. But it's just to keep doing it, just keep enjoying it. And that's why I quit building houses. There's a lot of stress in building houses. To me, flipping houses is like being on vacation. So I mean, I'm enjoying myself, and every day, I don't care if it's Monday, Sunday, or whatever, every day is a good day to get up and go.
Yeah, it's awesome. Absolutely. There's a question we ask everyone, and it mostly pertains to house hackers, but let's just talk about individuals in general. The question is, what separates potential house hackers from those that actually do it? But let's rephrase it in the fact that, like, what separates those from, you know, who want to do something whether in real estate, whether it's house hacking or anything, from those that actually do it? Like, what do you think separates individuals from doers from the pretenders?
Well, you know, it's, I tell people all the time, there's a lot of people out there, a lot more qualified than I am, a lot smarter, especially this day and time with all the technology we have. You know, like I told you, I just got on Zillow for my first time this last week. It's the willing to do it, take the chances. You know, it's not about being smart. It's not, I mean, you need to know what you're doing, but you can learn it. But you got to have something in you that makes you grind when the days are tough, when it's not going good, or you get a call in the middle of the night, one of your houses on fire, or a tenant tears everything up, and then they come steal your copper for $40 of copper, and you got to put a $6,000 heat and cooling unit back in. You know, you got to have you've got to see the carrot at the end of the string to keep you going, you know.
Yeah. And what is that? What is that? Because, I mean, you bring up a great point. I feel like not enough people, you know, want to talk about this because it doesn't bring people into real estate, right? And it doesn't sell their courses or their books or whatever to talk about what you're talking about. But, like, that is so true. I mean, you know, it isn't it's not the highs that, in my opinion, define someone in real estate or really in life. It's the lows and, you know, and being able to sustain yourself during a lows to get back to maybe a high or, you know, whatever. What is that? Like, what you know, that carrot? What is, you talked about the carrot. What is the carrot?
You know, I think it's something that's in you. I don't think you can. I mean, you can get into real estate and buy a property, or you can start a business. But I think it's something that's in you. You know, there's a want that you want. There's something driving you. As for me, I did a video on one of mine talking about failure. My grandparents were poor. My parents was poor. I wanted to break that cycle. I don't want to be poor. You know, it's not the money hungry. It's just, you know, and it's like I told my son the other day, you know, and I don't mean this like a brag, but I'm worth $7 million. And you never get over that, you know, thought that something could happen still. It takes something drastic to get everything, but you never get over that. When you've been poor and you've been broke, I mean, even when I had to start over, I couldn't get a $19 pager in my name, and I had a daughter fixing to start college. I had sold off all my rental property I had at that time to be able to stay in business. It wasn't nothing to do with my rental property. That was my salvation again. It was my home building business, you know, just made mistakes. You know, you learn through life, you know. I have people say, well, you just have 100-something pieces of property. Hey, I've sold property. I've kept property. I've traded property. This has been my living. I've raised my family, my kids. You know, I've lived life doing it. This has been my life, but it's been my living too, you know. And I've lived good. You know, I tell my wife, we look back, we had about 2 years, 22 years ago. It was rough. You know, it was just a bump in the road now. But, you know, this business, it took somebody like me. I'm not educated. I barely got out of high school. Got married making $1.60 an hour minimum wage. And to go from that to be a multimillionaire. And I don't know, are y'all sports fans?
Absolutely.
Okay, you like Alabama football. Like, you know
yeah,
Nick.
Well, yeah, he screwed us at Michigan State. I'm a Michigan State fan.
Okay, well, you know who Coach Saban is.
Oh, yeah.
He lives three houses up from me.
No kidding.
So, I mean, and I'm not saying that. I mean, I told my wife we moved here. They've got doctors, lawyers, a football coach. Now they got a redneck in here. But this business has took me to that, you know.
Yeah.
Not once, but twice. You know, it's a great industry. It's a great business. I mean, what else can you do that you can start with nothing, no education? And like I said, I come out of the trade background. You know, I still sometimes kind of play it down. I tell somebody I'm just a carpenter, you know, because that's what I was.
Yeah.
But the difference in me, I didn't want to just be a carpenter. I was curious. I want to know how you build a house and sell it. How you buy it. Like I said, I kept up 40-something houses for a man with my wife. I was putting her through college. I did the rental, you know, on his rentals. I did the maintenance. And I'm thinking, well, he don't have the headaches I got him. You know, there's something to this. Well, you know, I'm in my early 20s doing that. When I went to work at the university, I worked there for 10 years in maintenance, housing maintenance, never in the classroom. I worked in the rental properties and dorms. What better training? You know, mine is tough. But I become a real estate agent in 1983, part-time, because I thought it'd help me find more deals. like found out I liked that. So I went full time in 84 building houses and selling real estate. 1986, I got my broker license, went out on my own, been in business for myself ever since, whether it be building, remodeling, flipping, selling real estate. It's, you do what, you know, you, the more tools you have in your toolbox, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So we talk a lot about books, and we always ask our guests some of their favorite books. Do you have a favorite mindset or business book that you'd recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, I've read so many. What's so bad? I was telling somebody that when people started asking me this since I've been on Instagram, and I got to think about, well, you know, I got a book. Everybody likes Robert Kiyosaki, you know. Of course, I've read his book, you know. In fact, I bought his, you know, Rich Dad, Poor Dad for both my kids years ago. Highlighted everything I wanted them to think about. I have a daughter too. She's a nurse, but she's nothing to do with the industry. But so there's people don't realize that Donald Trump and Robert Kiyosaki wrote a book together. Mm-hmm. It's a good book. And I said, well, I'll tell them about it. So I got to look at it. It was 13 years ago or 14. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I hadn't read a lot of new books, you know. Like I said, that's why it was so, because this is what I've lived every day. But by doing this Instagram, it's helped me remember why I do things or how, you know, and listening to the podcast and stuff. But long story short, three books influenced me when I got started. Like I said, I had either my first child was born, another one on the way. This is 1980. And one child, another one was, maybe she was expecting, 18 months apart. But anyway, I read an article, I'm going to date myself, in Reader's Digest. It was called Beating Inflation with Real Estate. Well, they listed three books. One by Robert Allen, Nothing Down. One by Albert J. Lowry. His was called Beating Inflation with Real Estate. I think it's what his actual book title was. I'm not sure. And then the third one was a man named William Nickerson, says how I turned $1,000 into $1,000,000. And they had to upgrade it later on. He's like the granddaddy of all the books. Mm-hmm. He wrote this book in the 60s. And I actually got to meet two of the three authors. And over my years, at one time, I went to a seminar in the late 80s, early 90s, only seminar I've been to, and I met one of them. But long story short, my mother said, what would you like for Christmas? I said, I'd like these three books. I couldn't even buy the books, man. I got a baby. I'm working side work, putting a wife, you know, through college, doing all that stuff. And to this day, I keep those three books in my bedroom, sitting up on a stand with bookends. So, you know, it always reminds me where it all started.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Very cool. And I have never read any of those. I've heard of them for sure. Well, Rick, we really, really appreciate you coming on. We genuinely enjoy each one of your videos, and you are pretty consistent at posting, you know, almost one a day, usually one a day. Where can people find, you know, those videos and find out more about you?
Well, it's Real Estate Old School on Instagram. And I also have a YouTube page, which is basically the same things I upload there. So not as much, but excuse me, and it's Real Estate Old School also.
Awesome. Well, Rick, again,
one more book.
What's that?
Could I tell you about one more
book? Yeah, one more book.
Absolutely.
Okay. This book is when I was going through the hard times in the 90s that I got a hold of. There's a guy, have you ever heard of Trammell Crowe?
I don't think so.
Trammell Crowe Properties, Lincoln Properties. Anyway, he was in line to be the richest man in the United States instead of Sam Walton. He got caught up in one of the commercial turndowns, you know, later on. But anyway, at this time, he was still really, really getting it. And still, he's dead now. But anyway, he was a very wealthy man. But he wrote a book called Trammell Crowe Master Builder, or they wrote one on him. And in this book, when I was having to start over, I dealt with a lot of partners because people knew I could make money. I was honest. They knew what I did. So if people's got money, they want to work with you. So I had to actually set up companies with different, like accountants, attorneys, appraisers. And I was doing business with, not my rental business, but I'd be doing building and flipping or whatever. And what that did, it gave me the opportunity that I was making money, my money. I might only been getting half the profit, but I could put mine into my rental when I was, you know, getting started over. But he had a, there's a diagram in this book. It's like a spider web. He had all these different partners. And the only thing the partners had to do with each other, he's in the center. It's like, I might be a partner with you. We have a company, and I might have a, be a partner with you, and we'll have a company. And y'all don't know about the other. I mean, you know what's going on, but it's nothing to do with each other, what I'm saying. And that's how he structured and built his company to where he was. And that's kind of the pattern I use coming back. And I always tell folks, it's easier second time around. You're a lot smarter.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Rick, again, we really, really appreciate you coming on. You're a true, genuine person. And anyone that doesn't follow you, we highly recommend you go over, follow Real Estate Old School. And I mean, I learn something new every time I listen to you, and you just speak it the way it is. And you talk about the highs as, you know, just as much as you talk about the lows, and you really do keep it real. So we appreciate that.
Man, I appreciate that. I do. It's really, when I started, it's been for nothing more than just to help people. And I told my wife, it looked like this may turn into something. We get some paid vacations, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I tell folks never once in my videos, am I trying to sell you anything? Right. I tell them one day I'm going to write a book. If I do, I'm going to try to sell it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we appreciate it. And if you ever write that book, you make sure you make me the first one you let know, and I'll buy it.
Thank you, buddy. I appreciate you.
All right. You have a great right. day.
Thank y'all.
Thanks for coming on, Rick.
You bet. Right. Thank y'all.
Thanks for listening. If you could do me a huge favor and go give us a 5-star rating on iTunes, I would really appreciate it. It would really help us out. If we provided any value, please go do that. Otherwise, there's a lot of people who haven't subscribed, so go ahead and go subscribe, and you'll get notifications when a new podcast episode is released. Thanks again, everyone. Have a great day.